how long's it been since we last did our series? We're still sitting back. We're waiting for developments for this thing to get started or not to get started. We're waiting for bad news from the front, or just any news at this point. We've been following the whole Prigozhin thing. We've been following the whole supply scandal. And it's been quite a ride. I've been writing a lot. I've been watching it a lot, reading a lot. I know Riley has been as well. But let's circle back. I mean, a lot of these things that are being brought up now have been known for a while. And I guess it makes sense to just go back to the man who was talking about this for about a year already. And I think the last set of questions really rounds out things pretty nicely. So what do you say, Ryan? Let's tackle the last 13 questions in Strelkov's Angry Patriot Manifesto, where he asks uncomfortable questions of, I don't know, who is it addressed to? It's just like him shouting in the wind, I suppose. It's to us. It's to us. He wants us to answer the questions, right?
Let's do it, Rollo. Should I read the first one?
Sure. Oh, also, before you jump right in, it's funny. I was reading the comments on your big post about maybe Prigozhin is just really getting stressed out. Do you read your comments, by the way, or is it just too much? I didn't read all of them, but
yeah, I do. But I mean, honestly, anything war related on my blog, I mean, you just get bombarded with a lot of sadness. That's what I'll say.
Yeah, I was about to say. Let's hope that this helps these poor lost souls a little bit.
Yeah. All right. So I believe we're on number 27, which is, on what basis was under mobilization carried out if we do not have a war, in scare quotes, and the so-called special military operation does not have any legal status? On what basis, in this case, are citizens who have left their military units brought to criminal responsibility?
All right. Look, so here's the thing. Here's what happened, right? The Russian government has proven that they only act in the very last minute to do anything, right? So they already figured out that they didn't have enough men when the advance stalled out in the summer. And then they figured out that things were about to get really, really bad when they got when they lost the north and lost all those supply depots. Maybe it was deliberate. I know Strelkov was entertaining the idea that it was deliberate, that all this stuff was left behind to be captured. And there was a lot of it. So at that point they realize, oh wow, like we're about to lose this, not war decisively, because we are extremely outnumbered, because these guys have been mobilizing while we've been using up our professional contract soldiers. It was basically a repeat of Iraq, right, where Americans sent in like what, 200,000 maybe less Americans, and then they realized that they needed more, so they started grabbing all of these National Guards units, right, and extending these contracts, like extending the tours of the soldiers, or cutting the amount of time that they had on break and just throwing them back in because they didn't have enough men. And so Russia thought that they could be like America and send in a very small invasion force. And then they found out, just like America, that actually they need a lot more. So they carried out the partial mobilization. And you know, that's one of the main, that's a big question, is why did they only do the partial mobilization? Or possibly, why did they do a mobilization and a half? Like in winter, they probably quietly supplemented it. Why did they do that? Why so little? Like, why not? And you know, to answer this question is so difficult, because, you know, there's one answer that says that they're deliberately trying to lose this war. Another answer that says they're deliberately trying to prolong this war. Another answer that says that, well, Shoigu stole everything. Pilfered everything, and Gerasimov too, because that was the guy, you know, these two were working hand in hand. So they knew that they couldn't mobilize more men because they lacked like training infrastructure, you know, reserve officers. They lacked equipment because they'd already, you know, they had completely dismantled that system.
Yeah, I mean, it's a, you can go pretty deep with this one, but I guess that I mean, you pretty much, you covered most of the bases, I would say. I would only add that I do think it's important to remind ourselves, and Strelkov points it out in the question, Like, what is the special military operation? What is its legal status, right? I mean, even the most basic stuff has never really been explained to the Russian people. And I think one of the reasons why Moscow was so hesitant to mobilize is because they themselves don't really know what it is. And so how can you expect the public to take up arms if you yourself cannot explain precisely what they're fighting for and what sort of legal frameworks they're fighting? So this is also a thing that comes up again and again in these 39 questions, but it's worth repeating that there's never been a time where Moscow just puts it very plainly, what are the concrete objectives of this war? I'm not talking about fighting against isms or the satanic West. I'm talking about a concrete military objective.
Yeah, how will we know that we won?
Yeah, I mean, it just, I'm sorry, but anyone who's claiming that this war, there's just enough with the abstract concepts. And in my opinion, it's pretty obvious why an average Russian would even be hesitant to take up arms, even if they were called up, for the simple reason that going to denazify Ukraine doesn't make any sense to a normal person. Like, what does that constitute? How do you achieve that militarily? So anyway, that's what I would add.
Yeah, it's like the war on terror. How do you defeat terrorism? You know, like that, I mean, yeah. That was even stupider. Like, that's like defeating a tactic, you know? Yeah. What does that mean? But
exactly.
Yeah, when we talk about concrete goals, it's like when we reach the river, when we take this city, when we put this guy in the government, when a referendum is held, when these territories are taken, when, you know, concrete goals. I'm sorry, but yeah, Riley's right. Denazification doesn't mean anything. What does that mean?
Can I just add that the only concrete goal here was to stop the attacks on Donbass, which are this goal, which is really the most straightforward, concrete objective, is nowhere near complete. And the shelling and the attacks on Donetsk and other cities in Russia, in Donbass, have only probably increased tenfold since the start of this war, with horrific civilian casualties.
Yeah, what's worse is that now they're going to have to pull out. Well, I mean, there's an evacuation going on. And I think that if they just do them, this actually gets to a question further down. So I'll save it for that. Let's just move on to number 28. Why is mobilization reserved exclusively for reservists and the structures of the MOD of the RF and all other necessary components of normal mobilization? Mobilization of security and law enforcement agencies, mobilization of industry, transport, etc., are not carried out at all. Who determined the criteria for mobilization, which literally everyone who does not want to go to war could avoid? What mechanisms are provided in the absence of legal status of the SMO for draft evaders into the armed forces? I don't know. This one's kind of technical. I think a lot of cops were called up in the beginning, right? I don't know.
They were. There was even, there are reports of it, of, what are they called? Obmann, right? Like the SWAT Obmann guys.
And Sober.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, they were called up. I'm pretty sure that there are confirmed reports of that. I mean, I think that what Strelkov is just getting at, and he says it in, like, five of the questions are basically saying the same thing, which is why did mobilization suck so much ass, right? Like, why couldn't we do this correctly?
Yeah, well, number 29, well, I don't know what else to add to that. I mean, that's just like very detail-oriented. Number 29, though, is kind of what I was trying to get at. So who exactly made the politically difficult decision to leave the heavily fortified and successfully held Kherson bridgehead without a fight? On what basis was the territory of the RF surrendered to the enemy? Why have we not heard a single word in any state media that this territory will certainly be liberated? And vice versa, why are direct calls to freeze the conflict at existing positions? Prigozhin, for example, not being pursued by law enforcement agencies of the RF as a call to violate the territorial integrity of the Russian Federation. Kherson is now no longer Russia. Who decided so? On what basis? Yeah, this one's kind of damn. Like, that's like, oof. That's like kicking the Russian government when they're down. Don't you think? I mean, he's really driving the knife in with this one. So, okay, what he's saying is that they had a referendum and they decided to incorporate these territories into Russia. Then they lost these territories after pledging them that they would defend them. They didn't even defend them because they pulled back, right? We can get into that because it's relevant to the second point I was going to make. But yeah, they promised these people that now you're part of Russia and that's it. You're golden. You're good to go. And then they left without a fight. And now, you know, technically that if they were a part of Russia and they were attacked, then that was an attack on Russia directly, which is another red line that we hear so much about, right? And then, yeah, it's like, well, why aren't they saying that they're going to liberate these territories again? Well, we know the answer to that. It's because they want a ceasefire. They want negotiations. They want to slow this thing down at least. So he's hinting at that too. And then he doesn't like Prigozhin, so he's taking a stab at him there. But the reason why Prigozhin is calling is talking about this is because everyone's talking about it, maybe not in the state media. But everyone understands what the game is. Everyone understands that we're in the final days. Everyone understands that Russia is going to surrender, or not surrender, but like try to negotiate under unfavorable terms. It's quite obvious. That's why they're not calling for, you know, a new offensive to take back what was stolen from them. They're done. They're done with that. So he knows that. He's just driving the knife in. As for the difficult decision, well, we might have another difficult decision in the next week or so in Zaporozhye, because it's quite simple, the math here. If you don't have enough men and you cannot stop the breakthrough force, like if you cannot hold the defensive position, if it's overwhelmed and the enemy starts pouring in, and you do the math and you know you're going to be surrounded and outnumbered, you have no choice but to retreat. You can retreat after they take the bridgehead, I mean after they break through the lines. Or if you think that it's the odds really are overwhelming against you, you can do it before, which is what I think they did with Kherson. They just didn't have enough men. Besides, the bridges were shot. So, you know, they were having troubles with supplies. Anyway, I think that we'll see, obviously, but it wouldn't surprise me at all to see Russians pull back without a serious fight. And that would be the correct decision, I would argue, because if you are outnumbered, there's no point in fighting. You know, ideally you fight when you're not outnumbered. And that's probably why Ukraine is attacking. They wouldn't be attacking if they were outnumbered, you know? They're probably attacking because they think if they attack, they probably are doing it because they think that they have a good shot, you know? And so, yeah, they might actually take these regions without much of a, you know, without like a very serious fight. We'll see. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me, but the real thing is that, you know, the real question is not what they'll do now. You know, the peace has already been set. It's like, why didn't they spend the last 6 months reinforcing these areas? I mean, already in the summer, we knew that they weren't going to advance. So they'd already stalled out and they were already trying to, you know, just defend what they had. So they had at least 6 months more to prepare for this. So we'll see if they have, right? What else can I say?
Yeah, I would just add something that I find truly incredible is how you don't hear anything about Kherson anymore, even though it's legally a territory of the Russian Federation. You don't hear anything about it in Russian language media. You obviously hear nothing about it from the 5D boys in Western media. Where is the discussion about taking this territory back or launching, you know, some sort of operation to sabotage the enemy occupiers on Russian territory? You don't hear anything about it. nothing. People, it seems like people are, have just decided that, I don't know, Rolo, but it's just absolutely bizarre to me that no one talks about it anymore. Just this bizarre amnesia, or I don't know what it is.
I think these people are liars, and I think they know what's going on, and that's why they don't talk about it. Like, but I don't know. Maybe I'm giving them too much credit. You know, maybe they do. Maybe they believe the lie, like George Costanza. Are they really lying if they believe the lie? Question for the ages. Yeah, I don't know what to say. I mean, it's kind of obvious what's going on with that. We know why they're not talking about it. It's because they're not planning on trying to take it back. And why are they not planning or thinking about taking it back? Because they can't, or they don't want to. They don't want to commit more men. They don't want to commit, you know, make new equipment. They don't want to make hard changes in the staff or whatever. And the funny thing is the Kherson attack was the only one that was successful. And I think it's because it was the only one that, like, you know, it was cobbled together by someone else. It was like someone in Crimea that was in charge of that one. So the Ministry of Defense didn't have enough time to, you know, leak it to Langley or whoever. But that's just, you know, that's just conjecture. I'm sure we'll find out more as time goes on. So that was 29. Well, we're getting close. Number 30. Where is the official comment on St. Petersburg governor and new normal fanatic Alexander Beglov's decision to speak in front of the Ukrainian flag? What is he referring to? Oh, the plenary session of the Interparliamentary Assembly of the... Is that like a real organization of the CIS countries? I don't even know what that is.
Yeah, I guess so, because they held in St. Petersburg with the Ukrainian flag.
What were they discussing?
Probably, you know, regional cooperation or whatever, what they always do.
I just didn't think that the CIS format was like even a real thing anymore. I don't know. I don't know what the question is. Like, why are we still cooperating and holding talks with Ukraine and pretending everything's okay? And like, I don't know. Yeah, I guess that's a, this just, he doesn't, I don't think he likes Beglov either. I think he hates Beglov.
Everybody hates Beglov. Prigozhin hates him.
Yeah.
Strelkov. Yeah. I don't know anyone who likes that guy.
31. Why is the concern for the preservation of the Russian people and the Russian language declared by the president and top officials of the Russian Federation not applied to Ukraine, where the indigenous Russian population has been subjected to continuous cultural genocide for many years, and especially now? I think maybe what he means is that why didn't they do anything about it? I mean, this is not, it's been going on for 30 years, right?
Yeah. I guess that's what he's getting at. But at the same time, you have to at least give credit to, I mean, I think that the war itself shows that there was a very, very obvious policy failure in Ukraine. But, I mean, Moscow has pointed out that they feel as if Russian speakers have been discriminated against in certain parts of Ukraine, which, by the way, I think in some areas has maybe been, let's face it, has been a little bit exaggerated. Like this idea that Mariupol or whatever was like openly hostile to Russian speakers. Everybody was speaking Russian in Mariupol. It's not a big deal, right? Or in Kharkov, it's like completely Russian speaking, and yet it was flattened into a pancake. I don't know, but the Kremlin has brought it up, right? This sort of policy of removing the Russian language and, I don't know, replacing textbooks and all that stuff. You probably know more about it, Rolo, than I do. So,
yeah, I think Kharkiv was okay. I think only the suburbs got hit. But I don't know. I mean, when I was in Kyiv a couple months before the war started, I got eight times some irate person, Ukrainian, told me to F off back to Russia, which... it's funny, like the young people, it's like in Georgia, you know, where the young people flat out refuse to speak Russian. But they're also just like, you know, millennials and cucks. So like, they're not going to be like aggressive to you, to your face. But the older generation is much more uncouth and just aggressive and unhinged. So they'll definitely like, I had like older women saying this to me, like 45, maybe 50-year-old women. So there was a, I mean, it's not like I was denied service. I mean, I did go into one shop to buy a candy bar, and the woman like cussed me out. So I guess I was denied service one time for not speaking Russian. But let's just say I didn't feel like Martin Luther King or Rosa Parks in the American South, but there was hostility to Russian. When I was in the hospital waiting in line, some guy overheard me speaking with my grandfather in Russian, and he made a comment as well. But actually, the more I think about it, the more actually, I don't know. I guess I didn't internalize it as a victim type thing. But yeah, there was a lot of hostility now that I think about it. But I mean, it's a very rude city in general. So who knows?
Yeah, do you think though that it's probably just the worst in? It's bad in Kiev. I mean, what would happen if you went out? I don't know.
Well, actually, when I went to Lvov, it was much better. In the center of Kiev, like if you're a tourist and you stay in the nice parts, yeah, it's everyone speaks Russian because there's a lot of tourists, but mostly from Russia, or there used to be, and everyone speaks perfect Russian. And if you hear any Ukrainian in the center of Kiev, it's kind of quaint. It's like, oh, local charm, you know. But then you go to the suburbs and then the suburbs and like the exurbs, it's where all the bumpkins sort of moved in recent years because Kiev is growing like a cancer, just like Moscow. And so there you get this sort of like new Ukrainian or like the new Kievan. And yeah, they're pretty hostile. But when I was in Lvov, same thing. I spent my time in the center, spoken Russian everywhere. Everyone was cool with that. First they ask you, why do you not speak Russian, Ukrainian? I'm like, I don't know it. And then like, oh, okay. And it's fine. So I actually had a better time in Western Ukraine than I did in, but whatever, man, like this is, I don't even want to think about it right now. You're right. It's probably much, much worse. And there are a lot of people in Ukraine who don't even speak Ukrainian. So I don't know how bad it is for them. And then actually there was this thing in the news recently about a loyalty test being administered in the Baltics. And there are all these like old timer Russians there, Soviets basically. And they don't speak Latvian or Lithuanian or whatever they speak there. And they're like, they're being like denied citizenship on that basis or something like that. But I was under the impression that they weren't even given citizenship in the first place. They occupied this sort of like no man's land because Russia refuses to give them status and Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia refuse to give them status. I don't know what the situation is like there, but I would assume it's just as bad. It's funny that the Russian media never talks about the treatment of Russians in, say, the Baltics or in Kazakhstan. You know, it means they're not going to do anything.
And it could, you know, you could even extend. I think a lot of the sort of talking points that the Kremlin uses in Ukraine. I mean, for example, just NATO membership. Well, okay, like Finland just joined NATO, right?
Yeah.
Like some of this conflict is just made. It's made like it's not that there weren't legitimate grievances. It's just that somehow, well, it's there. Obviously, there's reasons why, but this conflict has just sort of made it all worse, right?
Yeah, but you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, you can't talk about the NATO-Finland thing. You can't talk about the Baltics. You can't talk about Kazakhstan. It's all eyes on Ukraine. God, I wish they'd started a fight in Kazakhstan instead. I mean, they had all the same reasons that, like, you would get mad at Ukraine. That's been going on in Kazakhstan and it's been much worse. And the repression has been much worse, you know? And there have been pogroms and ethnic targeting.
But Rollo, Kazakhstan is an ally.
Yeah, it's a sad situation. I mean, that's the thing. It's like you can't, like you have to, like if you pursue the truth in any way, shape, or form, you're going to run up against state propaganda from the West and the East. You know, you can't tell the truth about, you know, you can't actually tell me about the West caring about human rights, freedom, liberal, happiness, democracy, right? Because, you know, it is hypocritical. The way that they behave, and you know, we all know how the situation is at home in the West, and we all know how, you know, the West picks its allies. It's total hypocrisy. It doesn't do any good to call it out. These people don't care. But it's the same with Russia. It's like, yeah, you've made your case for why you had to do what you had to do in Ukraine. It doesn't justify you doing it so badly and, you know, destroying your own army and basically the future of both nations. I mean, good job with that. You've brought around the absolute worst case scenario. But you could also apply the same argument to the Baltics. You could apply the same argument to Kazakhstan. They don't. It's selective. And in fact, you get in trouble for bringing up Kazakhstan. Like, yeah, but whatever. Whatever. I'm so sick of these people. So sick of trying to put up with this bullshit. 1.5 years of this bullshit. It just gets worse and worse. Okay. Number 32, what is the reason for and what is the basis for the strategy of the RF armed forces in which operational offensive operations are carried out almost exclusively on the territory of Donbass and results in months-long bloody assaults on the enemy's most fortified lines? Well, even the capture of these lines does not lead to the defeat of the armed forces of Ukraine and the surrender of the Kiev regime. Why are other strategic directions stubbornly ignored? Where the offensive promises much more serious successes that can influence the outcome of the war? Why is initiative completely given over to the enemy in these directions? Great question. We've talked about this, haven't we? Why not just go from the north? Again, you've already proven that you can do it. Move the fight somewhere else. Leave the fortified. What I mean, do we have an answer to this?
Well, you know, I mean, Rollo, if you go back, I mean, it's hard to even remember it because the lies and the bullshit has just, it's been an endless flood. But if you recall, the whole idea, right, when the Kiev faint, right, was that this was going to be used so that they could distract forces in the north and then do this incredible, amazing Donbass cauldron that would just consume. It would consume all of these Ukrainian forces in Donbass and they'd be forced to surrender. This is what all of the usual suspects were saying back in basically a year ago. And we've talked about this again and again. It's like the one actual military objective that is clear-cut and tangible is pushing the Ukrainian military out of the Donbass. And I mean, we are maybe years away from that. If the Russian military keeps progressing at this pace, right? So how do you justify that? Like where, even, you know, the top war guys are like, we're supposed to have the second strongest military in the world. And we can't even take Bakhmut or push the Ukrainian military out of a relatively small area of Ukraine. So yeah, I don't know, Rollo. Maybe we're just repeating ourselves, but maybe you want to add in, chirp in.
No, I mean, there has been a lot of bullshit. But the thing is that it's actually shocking how much they've like controlled the acceptable level of discussion. Like if you and I were to ask one of these people, you know, Kremlin propagandists or 5D propagandists, the same thing. They promote the same line. You know, just like an innocent, like a child. Like why not try attacking from another direction? This doesn't seem to be working. You've been at it for 8 months, 9 months. Why don't you try something else? And it's like, you fool, don't you understand? And then they just like spit all this bullshit at you that even Prigozhin himself will deny. He'll say, yeah, Bakhmut's not that important. We just needed to attack somewhere because the whole line was falling apart and we needed to like give our army time to regroup and reorganize. And frankly, it was the only place we could attack. And then what else did he say? He said, yeah, and so we wanted to draw them into this fight. Bakhmut's not strategically important. What's important is this line of defense behind them, you know? And so it's like, yeah, well, why don't you change up the pace? Why don't you, Russia on paper has electronic warfare capabilities. Why don't you try that? I don't know. Why don't you try going in from the north? Why don't you try using your boats? I mean, you have a navy and they don't, in theory, anyways. Anyway. Number 33, where did all our latest military, why are the T-54, 55 tanks and D-20 guns, which were used in Stalin's time, put into service at the front in combat units? who scattered in huge quantities as a rule free of charge. Much more modern but unnecessary Soviet weapons and munitions across Syria, Libya, Sudan, and other African republics. Who should be responsible for this? Where are the promised combat robots? Where are the tens of thousands of Arab volunteers who are grateful to us for the assistance rendered and promised to the president by the Minister of Defense? I assume that they sold them all off, right? That would be my assumption. I hope they sold them off. I hope they didn't just give them away for free. Like,
so there's even a funny update on this one. I don't know if you saw the latest from Strelkov, but he posted it, I think, an hour or two ago on his Telegram channel, where he was talking about the Victory Day parade in Moscow and commenting on the fact that there was just one T-34 tank and there was no other tanks that were in the parade. And he was like, look, why didn't we bring out the archers? We could have brought out the archers and marched them through Red Square. I mean, he basically is saying, like, where is all of our hardware? What did we do with our military budget? That's basically what he's saying, right? And also, how is it that we had all these huge stocks of munitions and supplies that we inherited from the Soviet Union, and they apparently were either sold off or never put to proper use? And this just gets back again to, like, I think that it's clear, it's absolutely clear that the Russian military has been bogged down by very, very severe chronic systemic corruption for a very long time. And a lot of the promises that were made, a lot of the hype, it's just not real. There's just nothing behind it. I don't know, Rolla, what do you think?
I too was expecting combat robots. That's all I can say. the tens of thousands of Arab volunteers, huh? I mean, that's pretty funny. That's like, I don't even know what analogy to draw here. It's similar to what, for example, White Army people were saying, that, oh, soon the French will come and save us. Oh, soon these volunteers are coming, you know, losing everything. And
yeah, but Roll, this was a real sort of meme that existed in the first weeks of the war. You should go back and look it up. I'm pretty sure even Shoigu said it directly to Putin, that 20,000 volunteers from Syria were going to come and help the war effort or something. Like, this was announced on government airwaves.
Yeah. Well, look, we know Shoigu is a shameless liar and a charlatan and a thief and a gangster. And, you know, fuck it, I'll say it. He's not even Russian. I don't care. Like, you know, so, like, why? Why are we surprised by any of this? It's just... okay. Man, I'm not going to make it, dude. I'm dying as I'm reading this. It's a good thing we broke it up into three parts. How did it happen that Kazakhstan, saved by our peacekeeping... Oh, my God, he's about to... Yeah. So saved by our peacekeeping forces from a civil war literally a month before the start of the SMO, is quickly and openly moving... demonstrating growing Russophobia and gradually joining all types of sanctions. Yeah, who made the decisions to support exactly the group that, being nurtured by the Soros Foundation, which is well known, is now in power in Kazakhstan? Yeah, what served as the basis for supporting this particular group, although there were others who were much more loyal to the Russian Federation?
All right, Rolo, can I ask you a question? Because the narrative, at least in the little media circles that I operate in, was that the intervention by Russia was allegedly supposed to stop the Soros color revolution. But Strelkov seems to suggest that people who have friendly relations with Soros are still in power over there. So what is he saying? And do you agree with what he's saying?
There's two Soros factions. Well, I mean, forget the Soros thing. That's such a... Yes. The thing. Okay, here's the thing. Just look at the facts. And I wrote this article about Kazakhstan. It wasn't in-depth about the situation there now. But the situation is pretty much this, that Tokayev is a very progressive reformer. And he is doing everything that he can to bring Kazakhstan into line with the requirements of the New World Order or Europe and the West or whatever. So he's basically selling the whole country out to the West in the process of it. He's letting all these people from the West invest. He's pushing very radical social reforms, like extreme levels of feminism that we don't even see in, well, not in Ukraine and Russia, but, you know, you don't even see that sort of thing in like Hungary or Poland. Very extreme level stuff, like mandatory gender quotas in the workplace, government workplace, mandatory gender quotas in political parties, you know, like expanding police powers to, like, you know, arrest men that women complain about, you know, like domestic violence type stuff, extreme feminism propaganda, quotas at universities, you know, just this like really over the top stuff. They're promoting a lot of this, you know, social liberalism in all spheres. And if you read like their flagship Astana Times, they're very proud of it. They brag about it. They're basically signaling to the West, we will do everything to be like you. And so what has occurred is that resistance to this agenda, and at the same time, Tokayev is extremely corrupt, right? I mean, he's a globalist creature, and the people around him are he's basically giving green light to loot the country, to invest in the country, to buy out the country, to basically for international finance to run Kazakhstan. So, and then there's opposition that's risen up to him. One of that opposition calls him an agent of Putin, which I guess he kind of is, in the same way that, like, what's his name, Kuchma, was an agent of Moscow. Not really. I mean, it's total BS. But that is the narrative that they're going with, that Tokayev is a Putin stooge. And so they're calling for rebellion and for these protests and for these riots in the name of overthrowing Russian influence in the country. You know, the reality is that there isn't any tangible Russian influence. It's just some oligarchs who are making money. But they've constructed this narrative that actually Russia is in charge of Tokayev, just the same way that they said that Russia was in charge of Kuchma, even though the complete opposite was the case. So there's that group. There's this group of oppositionists who are radical. They're anti-Tokayev, and they frame him as pro-Russian. And then there are Russians in the north who are trying to get out from under Tokayev and his extremely repressive government, which basically jails people for speaking out about the condition of Russians, even if they're Kazakhs. You know, Kazakhs have spoken out, and they get jailed as well. But, you know, they're not allowed to actually say the truth about why they're against what amounts to ethnic discrimination. So what they say is that Tokayev is like against traditional conservative values, and that's why we have to resist him. And, you know, Russia won't ever tolerate Russians saying, you know, hey, we're ethnically Russian. We belong with you. That's racism. That's colonialism. You know, this stupid leftover type ideology that they have in Moscow. So they have to pretend that their resistance is based on like traditional values or whatever. It's like when they get together with the conferences of European right wingers and they say, well, we're here because we're pro-family or whatever, some sort of euphemism. Anyway, and then you have so it's like that, right? I mean, it's a long explanation of things, but basically you have two factions at least that are, one is just as bad as the other. One will like start a war with Russia and by like pogroming Russians, pretty much. They already call them separatists. They call them Separs. They use the same language as the Ukrainians, and they basically they're gung ho. They just want to start killing or, you know, messing or provoking these Russians that are left in Kazakhstan. That's the group that mostly was going to come to power. You know, Tokayev is anti-Russian as well. And he's not actually shutting these people down very seriously. He let most of these people out of prison, even though a lot of them, I mean, like the egregious ones, the ones that killed cops, yeah, they're serving like 7 years or something. Most of them were amnestied, though. And so, anyway, it's like a whole thing where he's basically allowing this opposition to him that almost toppled him to continue growing in the country, probably because he's being paid by the West to do so, even though it's a threat to him eventually. And these guys are even more radical than he is. And Russia is not going to do anything about until the situation devolves into something akin to Donbass. And even then, they might just pretend nothing is going on because that's their MO. Like, you know, especially if they lose this war, then they'll be like, well, we're not going to try again. So anyway, this whole idea that Russia is pro-Russian is sort of fake. No, Russia's oligarchs are pro-money. That's it. That's all they care about. That's a long explanation. I didn't mean to go off on that, but just getting to me, man. It's getting to me. It's killing the upbeat, carefree Rolo vibe. But number 35, why do our officials blame some Ukrainian nationals for all hope, high-profile sabotage, terrorist acts, and simply military strikes in the territory of the RF? Removing responsibility for these acts from the official authorities and the military of Ukraine, even in those cases where they themselves publicly take ownership. Where are the similar actions of the Russian special services on enemy territory? Why hasn't a capable underground been created in Ukraine in 8 years, even in the Russian-speaking regions? Why are there no attempts to create it now, except for purely media and beneficial only to enemy propaganda provocations led by the scoundrel Medvedchuk? Riley?
Yeah, again, we have definitely touched on all these subjects before, and this idea that Medvedchuk was supposed to be Moscow's guy in Ukraine, it was such a poorly thought out idea, but also sort of taps into what you sort of touched on before, Rolo, which is this whole, I mean, I'm sorry, but the whole system in Russia is basically just, it's backed by this idea that you have a bunch of rich friends and it doesn't matter how crappy they are at their jobs or getting things done. You have to be loyal to them because everyone's getting their cut and nobody, you know, you don't want to be the guy who gets a Gaddafi or whatever, right? Or have the pitchforks and the torches coming after you. So everybody sticks together. And it's just insane. It's truly insane that there was never even a government in waiting, a government in exile for Ukraine. How do you do a special military operation, which was clearly...
They still don't have one.
They still don't have one, Rolo. How do you do an SMO where the obvious objective was regime change and not have a government waiting? A regime ready to take over. It was Medvedchuk, who is a fucking idiot.
Yeah, you'll have that. Can you hear me still? I got excited and I yanked on the cord.
Yeah, I can hear you. But I'm sure you, please, add what you need to add to here.
I mean, that's another thing, is that clearly there's not going to be a regime change in Kiev because they've had all this time to come up with a new regime. And yeah, Strelkov's right. You could carry out these operations there. Even now in Ukrainian territory, and you know how you do it. You say, well, look, you have to guarantee the rights of these activists. How do you do that? Well, hey, if you kill these activists who are campaigning for peace or whatever, we'll kill you. That's basically the only thing that guarantees any semblance of human rights. That's how the whole world works. Like, why do all these democracy activists in all these countries around the world who basically advocate for regime change and killing the ruling class and, you know, sodomizing the president of the current country, how is it that they're able to, you know, in these repressive authoritarian dictatorships, whatever, how is it that they're allowed to operate freely and basically undermine the rule of these evil despots? Well, because they have the U.S. or somebody else, mostly the U.S., in their corner. And so if the government, you know, kills them off or imprisons them or shuts them down, the U.S. retaliates. So what the U.S. does is they guarantee their agents of change some level of security. And Russia does not do that. Russia can't even guarantee the people that are now formally annexed and part of Russia any security. They keep getting blown up.
Yeah, can I just add, this is not an endorsement of Israel, obviously, but in Israel, the Israeli Mossad will, like, track down some random Arab guy and, like, follow him halfway across the world to, like, blow up him and his entire family over some sort of weird, you know, thing that happened 50 years ago. And Russia can't even, you know, it's a Russian-speaking, formerly part of the Russian Empire, formerly part of the Soviet Union country that's right on their border. And you're telling me that they can't figure out a good Like, they don't have a Secret Service cool thing going on in Ukraine. Like, how is that possible? How are they not capable of, we've talked about this for a long time. Why didn't they cuff all of the creepiest oligarchs in the first days of the special military operation? It would have made it very special. It would have been a very special thing to see. But obviously they're not going to do that. And frankly, I don't even know if they have the capability of doing it.
You mean like in Russia or like to kill them off in Ukraine?
No, I mean in Ukraine. Like, how is it that there's no? How is it that in a country where you would suspect, you would hope that the FSB or the, you know, foreign intelligence service would be able to blend in somewhat well in Ukraine, and you don't. These guys aren't doing anything. There's no big sabotage things like we're seeing right now in Russia with rail lines being blown up and strange fires and factories. You don't see anything, any of that in Ukraine, at least nothing that I've seen reported.
No, so it begs the question, what is the FSB doing with its budget? Yeah, it seems like it, like what I'm saying, the FSB is just an internal police used to curb internal dissent and to distribute drugs to the population. I mean, what else do these people do? I mean, it's ridiculous. They can't prevent terrorism. They don't want to, it seems like. They killed Darya Dugina. They killed Vladlen Tatarsky. And they almost killed, what's this guy's name again? Pelevin, right? They almost killed him. So,
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I'm just going to say, if there's one country in the world that should be crawling with Russian spooks, it should be Ukraine. And yet, where are they?
Yeah.
And what have they done? And this just goes back to the whole point that Strelkov is making this question, which is like, what did we actually do over the last 8 years? And he's not even talking about military preparations. He's talking about soft power, about, you know, clandestine operations, about creating a government in exile. Nothing was done, and we're seeing it so clearly now.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, it's just this the level of treachery, and it's just incredible. I mean, there's just, you know, yeah, there's really just no justification for it. I mean, I don't understand. Like, on the one hand, they're like, oh yeah, well, we're crushing Ukraine. We're so much better than Ukraine. We got it under control. And at the same time, we're supposed to believe that Ukraine is like this hyper competent Cobra Command. You know, what's some other Cobra Kai type, you know, ninjas in the mountains type operation that can strike at any time within Russia. And it's just, yeah, man, they're just so evil. They're just like goddamn ninjas. You know, we can't do anything about it. It's like, which one is it? Are they stupid and incompetent and sending 6 million people to die every day in frontline assaults? Or are they hyper competent and you're dealing with the Cobra Commando or whatever, and they infiltrated everything and they can blow anything up, and we got to be hyper vigilant and it's a fight to the last gasp? Like, what? Make up your mind. But they try to have it both ways. But why isn't Russia doing any of this stuff? I would assume that they were paid off not to do any of this stuff. I mean, that's probably the reason. I assume that the FSB, part of it, most of it, probably wants Putin gone at some point. I don't know. I mean, they would stand to inherit the country. It's not as crazy as it sounds. People forget that the Orthodox Church supported the overthrow of Tsar Nicholas II. You'd think that that would be like a match made in heaven, literally, between the Tsar and the Church, but you'd be wrong. Because they figured, well, once he's out of the way, we'll have more power. You know, is it really too much of like a stretch to think that an organization of gangsters and killers and thieves and con men, you know, there might not be that much honor among thieves, and maybe they are thinking about their future. And well, that'd be an interesting thing to consider. I mean, these are the descendants of the same people that allowed the Soviet Union to collapse. So first they'd arrest you if you advocated for any reforms or any changes to the Soviet Union. Then they arrested you if you wanted to, like, you know, topple the Soviet Union. Then they allowed the Soviet Union to topple, and then they arrested anyone who tried to prevent it from being toppled, and then they arrested anyone who tried to restore it. And now, you know, like it's not that crazy. These people change sides all the time. That's what happened. That's the history of the 80s to the 90s, right? So is it really that much of a stretch to think that maybe their alliance has shifted again or they could in the future? I don't think so. But we'll see. I mean, but the thing is that even if they did, and like we were to state the obvious that like, wow, it looks like they're playing for the other team now, or at least, hey, everything they're doing appears to be like something that they would do if they were playing for the other team, no one will believe us. People cannot see the obvious. You know, it's always some 5D narrative or something in their heads. You want to get the next one?
Yeah, sure. So, number 36, how is it that while hundreds of thousands of our soldiers, as well as the population of the frontline regions living in the zone of enemy strikes, are experiencing hardships, the rest of the country continues to live as if no war exists, or it is completely irrelevant to them? And I have a comment right off the bat here, which is I find it so incredible that there is this concerted effort, in especially in the 5D Western media, to portray, to create this image, especially in Moscow, which of course is Russia's wealthiest, most degenerate city, that look, I don't see any signs of the war. Russia's winning. There are no sanctions. Like, checkmate, loser globalists. It's like, if you have been constantly retreating for the last, what, 6 months, basically, or not able to advance in any meaningful way, and there's absolutely no sign of this so-called existential war in your capital, that's not a good sign. That's not something that you should be proud of, right? And it's just very, very strange to me how you have this, you have, again, it's this schizophrenia, where on the one hand, Russia is fighting the entire collective satanic Nazi West for its survival. And on the other hand, there's, oh, look, like, you can't even, it's so amazing how I can just go to my super overpriced restaurant in Russia and take selfies, and there's nobody talks about the war. It obviously shows that we're winning, right? And that it just doesn't, there's no logic here. There's no logic here. Or what do you think, Rulo?
You see that video making fun of Shoigu's daughter and her boyfriend?
Yeah, who are, I mean, you should give the background of them, Rolo, just for anyone who doesn't know.
I don't actually understand that story at all. I mean, he appears to be a homosexual. I mean, he's like good looking, but like in a very homosexual kind of way. He's like a little girly girl, and he's always like doing that like soy mouth, like, oh my God, look at the furniture. Oh my God, there's these women and they're doing all this stuff. It's so great. And he's got this gay everything about him. He's dating Shoigu's daughter. I think he's kind of rich himself. He's from some connected. And yeah, they just do these like lifestyle type blogs, and it's always them lounging somewhere, seeing some art, you know, just doing the socialite thing. And you'd think someone would tell them to like not do that during the war. You know, just can you just not make a big show out of how gay and ostentatious your lifestyle is for just, you know, for several 2 week periods? But no, apparently they didn't get the memo, and they continue to release stuff onto social media, and it rubs people the wrong way that this serious defense minister, you know, that's his image in the West. It's like he's the serious man. He's always scowling. He's, you know, he's out in the wilderness fishing or whatever, right? But, you know, his daughter's dating a flaming queer. This, you know, she appears to have tattoos. She's constantly doing like, you know, she behaves like a total whore. I mean, that's it. Now my life is forfeit. I've said what I should not have said about a powerful man's daughter, but he knows it. I don't even blame him for it. You can't control the women nowadays. If the defense minister of Russia can't control his out of control daughter, then what hope do any of us have? But yeah, so it's really easy to pick fun at the socialites and say, but the thing is that you're not even allowed to do that in Russia. That's the funny thing, is that this sort of Western mindset is so prevalent that it's like, and these people are so, it's, you know what I mean? It's like their cultural dominance is so established that at least in America, you can kind of, there are, you know, this criticism of celebrity culture and a lot of prominent celebrities in Hollywood, it's growing. Like you can actually, but in Russia, it's just still so dominant. Like there isn't this, you know, anyway, I mean, the fact that these people feel like they, I mean, it's basically like the celebrities in the West when they were doing these songs, when everyone was on lockdown, they were all selfie, like, you know, that, remember that meme where they were all like singing together and everything, they thought that it would be touching and people would be moved by that and everyone hated them for it. It's like that level of disconnect. But I think you've spent some time in these circles in Moscow, and I've spent some time in these circles in St. Petersburg. Not as high up, of course, but I mean, yeah, these people are completely divorced from the war, and they're all the kids of rich people. Russia's elite is hopelessly enamored of everything stupid and degenerate. It sucks. I mean, I'm whatever. Just read the next one, Riley. Just read the next one. What am I even?
Okay, hold on. Here we go. 38. We're almost done. Two more questions. What is the reason for the fact that people who for years defended the Minsk agreement and Donbass as part of a united Ukraine are now responsible for military propaganda, and people who always initially and reasonably warned about the disastrous nature of such a course and predicted what it would lead to, a big and difficult war, remain marginalized by official propaganda, up to the complete rejection of the opportunity to take part in the defense of Russia? Rollo, this is a topic that I'm sure you'd love to weigh in on.
I feel bad. I ranted already. You want to get your two cents in?
I mean, what can even... Basically, Strelkov is saying, why did you guys... Like, I told you so, right? Like, why did you guys ignore me? And also, he's pissed off because he can't actually fight in the war. But, yeah, look, it's what can even be said at this point? And it's so interesting to me. This is what I'll say, and then I want you to rant. But, you know, I came to Russia, like, right when Maidan started. And when the Minsk agreements were rolled out, the whole sort of, at this point, this was sort of the beginning of what I guess you could call sort of the pro-Russia Western media is really when it started around Maidan and with Crimea. And the Minsk agreements were hailed as this, like, Putin being this really humane guy who was trying to save the world from destruction. I mean, it was very, very pro-Minsk, and the only objection that people had to Minsk was that Russia was doing everything it could to make Minsk work, and the Ukrainians were violating it by shelling Donetsk periodically. Like, that was the narrative for years, Rollo, right? And so, and then just overnight, it was sort of like, we, like, killed the Nazis, like, take Kiev, when nothing actually fundamentally changed on the ground, right? Like, the situation, in fact, the reality is nobody wants to talk about this, but there was, like, no recorded deaths in Donetsk in 2021. According to the official UN figures, it's like 21 people killed. Okay, yeah, that's a tragedy. All those people who died, it's murder. It's very, very bad. 21 people are dying in a day now in Donetsk, right? So, and you compare those numbers to 2018 or 2014, and they're meaningless. So progress was actually being made in that respect. But the point is, if you go from Donbass should be reincorporated into Ukraine, and then the next day you're saying we have to send tanks into Kiev, it just doesn't make any sense. And so how can you make that argument if your job is to argue for this war, right? Like you're making this switch basically instantaneously without any sort of logical reason to it. And Strelkov is right. Like the 8-year gap here, the 8 years, what clearly happened was that Russia did nothing and Ukraine was preparing. And we're seeing the results now.
Yeah. I don't have anything left in the tank to rant about. I mean, I guess ideally, yeah, you wouldn't have If you have a group of people whose whole plan was to enforce Minsk 1 and 2, which was basically, in a nutshell, force Donbass kicking and screaming into Ukraine and make it Ukraine's problem. That was the whole, that's what the Dream Team thought up. So ideally, you would replace these people if you were going to try a new strategy. Instead, they were like, well, now we need you to argue for literally the opposite of what you did for the last 8 years. Yeah, well, you know. There's like, there has to be some front or like some area where they didn't mess up everything. Maybe we should try and find that, because so far it's just an entire list of just everything is messed up. Anyway, last one, I guess. Why are the closest relatives of the higher state and military leaders of the Russian Federation spotted by the Western media in countries openly hostile to the Russian Federation? Will any conclusions about these officials be made by the president? Well, yeah, there's quite a few of them. In fact, there's defense, Ministry of Defense official lovers and wives and second wives that have been seen cavorting all over Europe quite ostentatiously. I mean, most of the focus was on like the oligarchs and everything. And yeah, well, like we know about the oligarchs, but the ministers of defense, I mean, the deputies and various like other people, they're no exception to this either. That's what we didn't know. Now we know. And yeah, you're right. I mean, I don't know. Does the Russian state media cover, like, did you know that the guy who's in charge of supplies for like this front, his second wife, who is a bimbo, is in Italy, and she spends $50,000 a day, or was it 50,000 euros a month or something like that? How can a defense minister on a public servant's salary afford 50,000 euros a month? You know,
I didn't see it on RT, but it doesn't mean that they didn't cover it. I shouldn't make assumptions. Who knows?
Well, that's not even a topic for RT. It should be covered in domestic Russian media, right? The Russian people ought to know that their defense minister, this would be a scandal, right? That the defense minister of your country, one of the deputies, I mean, that his wife is first of all, spending colossal amounts of money. Second, I mean, that's corruption. Second of all, she's spending, I mean, she could do that in Dubai at least, or in China. That'd be one thing, you know, but no, it has to be. Yeah. Anyway, but there's other examples too. You know, for example, Lavrov's daughter had an $11 million pound flat. That's like $1 million, right? I mean, that's probably not all that they had, but that's what we learned about. Solovyov, the head propagandist, you know, this very unlikable man on Channel One, his son is a homosexual, also living in London. Peskov's son apparently was involved in gangsterism as part of like some Muslim gang, also in London. I mean, it's just incredible. I mean, what's his name? Putin. What's his name? Putin's daughter, one of them, was married to some Dutch guy who seemed all right. An oligarch tried to assassinate him in Russia, but he got killed for that, I think. But he seems like an okay man. I'm not saying anything against him. Good-looking guy. They were also living abroad, and then he brought them back, I think, at some point. Anyway, yeah, it's all
and,
the...
There's so many other examples. I mean, one that just comes to mind is Matvienko, who is she's the chairwoman of the Federation Council, who apparently had some extravagant villa in Italy, which I think might have actually been seized. But then there's all the, you know, the stories of the yachts and I mean, that's mostly with oligarchs, I imagine. But yeah, you can't get around the fact that Russia's elites have a huge amount of property and, you know, bank accounts and other forms of capital that are sitting in the West, and they really want it. they really like it, and they don't want to lose it. And that should be, like, it's problematic, right, Rollo?
Yeah, weird thing is that all you need is, like, an attitude shift to at least steal the money and keep it at home. I mean, it's like all you need to do is just, invest that stolen money in your own country. Build yourself a country villa. You can do that. Like, you, I mean, there's so many abandoned palaces. Like, all of, I mean, that's my dream. It was always to find all of the, I mean, just in St. Petersburg, the whole, it's covered in abandoned palaces. It's just woods, you know, it's incredible. Just, I would love to take one of these old, amazing buildings, restore it, you know, put up some statues and a nice lawn. Bada bing, bada boom, I can feel like I'm fancy, you know. But these people seem to have an ideological hatred of Russia. They just simply cannot be. I mean, why not do some, go to someplace nice instead of Italy? Why not go to like Vietnam? They had a deal with the Vietnamese in the north. A lot of soldiers retired there. Great beaches, great food, you know, lots of retired, you know, army types. A lot of fun to be had in Vietnam. They can't even go there. You know, go to Thailand for Christ's sake. You know, a lot of middle class people from Russia, they go to Phuket. You know, set up your villa on Phuket. You know, why has it got to be Italy? You know, why has it got to be London? Why has it got to be Florida? You know, it's New York. It's ridiculous. Anyway, it's kind of a weird complaint, but it's just like the level of, yeah.
If you're gonna steal money, spend it in Thailand.
Yeah, I mean, like, honestly, they just have no taste, is what I'm saying. Like, that's just such a Novo Riche move to make. You know, where do Italians go if they have any money? They're like, oh, let's go to the Philippines. Let's get out of here, you know? But we want to go someplace else. And then the Russians are like, oh, he's so fancy. I don't know. Stupid. Everything's stupid, Riley. I'm despondent, as you can tell. There's nothing positive to say. There's nothing positive. There's nothing I can say that, like, well, this has changed for the better. Yeah, some like celebrities and some business type people and some of the more egregious oligarchs fled the country. But if they lose the war, they didn't tear up their citizenships. These people should come right back, you know? They're probably planning to do that and steal some more. It's incredible. It's just incredible. And people are like, well, something's got to be done. Well, what can you do? What can you do? Every country has the same situation. You have a surveillance state. You have, you know, gangs of psychopaths with guns that make sure that you don't get uppity, right? There's two levels of rules, you know. The rules don't apply the same to sort of high-minded idealistic peasants, you know, who want to make things more fair. Well, those people get the boot, you know. That's in every country. It's in every country. I don't know why people think Russia is an exception. You know, in some ways, Russia is much more freer than the West, and like you can get away with a lot more, which is great. You can kind of push the envelope sometimes, but they can come down just as hard, if not harder, like we saw with COVID, where literal these like cops that are, I hope some of them were sent off to fight, were patrolling like playgrounds and just commie blocks on the prowl, like harassing people, demanding papers. Permission to be past 1,000 meters from their home, so they can go both ways. You know, it's all we can do, I think, is just like learn our lessons and just learn a lesson, understand how power works, understand and figure and just come to terms with the fact that how, you know, the world is not. I don't know how to put this. Just grow up a little bit. That's what I would say.
And I would add one thing to that, which you pointed out very succinctly and clearly in a recent post you wrote, which is, you know, if you do think, if you are on Team Z, if you are on Team Russia, if you do want the best for Russia, if that's why you're tuning in to the podcasts and reading the Substacks every day, is if that's your real genuine motivation, you should be focused on trying to make your team better. Right? Nothing you say or rant about the satanic Nazi West or Kiev, they don't care, and it's not going to change anything. You should be completely and entirely focused on trying to make your own side as good as it can be. And you should hold them, you should have high expectations for them and hold them to a standard that is, you should have standards, right? Your standards should not be, as long as they're a little bit less shitty than this really, really, really shitty other team, right? And this is just assuming, of course, that you know, at this point, I'm sorry to say, but a pretty good argument can be made that maybe there are no teams. Maybe we really are living in absolutely controlled from the above by space lizards, upside down garbage world, right? I'm sorry, but I think a case can be made for that at this point. But if you are on, if you do consider yourself on Team Z, if you do want the best for the Russian people, you should be advocating on their behalf, right? Instead of whining about the retards in Kiev or Washington.
You know, that's like such a profound paradigm shift if people could ever actually wrap their heads around it. What you just said, this idea that you should critique your own side. So for example, you know, if I'm like a conservative and I want, you know, things done, you know, right-wing measures taken, what will happen is I will watch Fox News and I'll listen to Sean Hannity and how he talks about like the Democrats and they're so silly and they did this and it's so bad. And it's just like this outrage porn, right? And nothing ever gets done, nothing, because you cannot affect the enemy, right? Unless you're like willing to like go into battle against them directly or in some way, there's nothing you can do. What's the point in obsessing? It's like half of these Telegram channels are just like incessantly making fun of Ukraine about like so-and-so said this and this, and isn't that so silly? Hee hee hee. What a funny country. It smacks of desperation. It reeks of like the same thing that Fox News conservatives would do. You know, isn't it so weird that they've got these people in dresses diddling kids? You know, the left will never learn. The left is so crazy. Whereas people like Jimmy Dore, who critiques the left from the left, he figured it out. I mean, that's why he's making change. That's why he's so hated. He goes after his own team, quote unquote. He's like, you guys promised us universal healthcare or something, and you promised us transparency and like, you know, freedom of speech, whatever it is that he cares about. And you're not upholding it. You're sellouts. And I'm not going to support you. You asked for our support. We gave it to you. And now you sold us out. And I'm holding your feet to the fire. And he gets into a lot of trouble for that. What did Tucker Carlson get into trouble for? He did the same thing, but he did it to the Republicans. And what is Strelkov doing? He's doing the same thing, but he's doing it to the Ministry of Defense. And so this is like the most unenviable position to be in, because the stupid peasants think that you're on the enemy's team or that you're breaking ranks or something, when in reality, you're the one doing the, you know, asking the hard questions. And I don't know what, I mean, Tucker was popular. Strelkov is actually extremely popular. It's just this, you know, there's a language barrier, I guess. People don't know enough about him. And, you know, a lot of these figures, and Jimmy Dore is popular, these figures that can sort of critique their own, because it's like, look, if you have an army, right, and you go into battle, you win or you lose, you know, if you fight well, then that's what it is, you know, and then it's in the hands of God. And that's pretty much all we can hope for. But the problem is when, you know, you have this army, but the half the army is not fighting, you know, half the army is shooting in the other direction, half the army doesn't have any ammo. And I'm using army as a metaphor here, but it could also apply to directly the situation in Ukraine. You know, you shouldn't be shouting orders at the enemy troops. Like, you shouldn't be trying to reform the enemy. That's what it is. Like, what's the point of criticism if you're like not trying to get something to change, right? So the reason why you would critique, perhaps, if so, everything is kind of premised on this absurd idea that we are having a debate, like that we're a debate society, and so you're presenting, there's a neutral audience and you're trying to present your arguments to the neutral audience, and then they decide who's presented the most convincing arguments or something. So they're throwing all this stuff at Ukraine and making fun of them and, you know, acting all smug. It's like, who are you trying to convince? We're almost 2 years. We're going to be 2 years into this thing, but at the rate that this is going, we're about a year and change into this thing. I mean, people have pretty much chosen their sides, and you're still going on and on and on, like just heckling basically the other team. And you're right, it's pointless. It's cheap shots. Nothing gets done. Your heckling is met on deaf ears. Their side's not reading your heckling. It's pointless. You should be, you should be like actually trying to figure out what can we do to make our side more effective. But whatever. I mean, I'm tired, Riley. I'm tired of trying to explain this stuff. You know, some people just get it intuitively. Others will never get it. There's no point. And, you know, it's just... none of this matters. It don't matter. None of this matters. You know who I'm quoting? Your favorite. Carl. None of this matters. Yeah, I don't know. Can you say something nice, man? I don't know. I just,
There are nice things to say, which is, I actually think, I'm not trying to exaggerate here, I actually do think the fact that Pepe Escobar has been plugging your stuff and wrote and openly basically called the Russian military bureaucracy incompetent on the pages of Strategic Culture Foundation, which, if you're not familiar with Strategic Culture Foundation, let's just say that it's not exactly reader funded, right? And that's huge. That's absolutely huge. This guy has an absolutely enormous following. And by doing so, I mean, look, I've been critical of Pepe in the past. I think we all have in some ways, but you got to give props to someone who's willing to just say, look, I've been saying something very different, but now the situation has clearly changed and there's evidence to show that. And yeah, like people should be talking about this. And that's what Pepe has basically done. And that's a feather in your cap, Rollo, on all of our caps in a way, right? That we are making some, we've established a small beachfront and we're slowly making inroads is what I would say.
Yeah, it is pretty cool. I'm just, I guess one of the things that causes depression is sometimes I read the comments as well. And there's this, now there's this new line that, like, I won't critique Putin. That means I'm paid off by Putin. It's like, well, look, here's the scheme. Okay. If you can pay me $1,000, that's what I want to write for you. And you can pay me $2,000 to not write anything at all. For $2,000, I'll just not write. And that's my offer to anybody, really, to the Kremlin. Whoever wants to pay me $2,000 to not write anything anymore, I'll take that offer. I think they're just too damn cheap, you know? Like, they spent all the money on their whore wives. And if they were smart, they'd pay me $2,000 to not translate and promote Strelkov in the West. That's all I would say to them. And I will tell my audience right now, immediately, if I was... I mean, you know, it's 2009. Now, but like, if the blog grows a bit, if Pepe Escobar's, you know, links and his seal of approval boost the blog, well, then the price is going to go up and it'll be $3,000 for me to not write anything at all. But the offer stands. If they want, they can just read out to me. I'll take my bag. I'll just write about like mysticism or something. It's all on the table. I don't like this, man. I don't like being all depressed and shit. And frankly, I'm writing for an English speaking audience. And it's not like they're going to be able to reform Russia, right? It's just academic, right? I hope that they can take some of the lessons and some of this. I hope that they can draw lessons from this whole thing and apply it to their own countries. And I hope that it makes them a little bit more cynical and jaded and makes them understand how politics actually works. Most of them will just say, oh, well, that's just Russia. Nothing like that could be happening here. And or most of them just won't be able to draw any lessons from it. I'm under no illusions. But at the same time, I think I had a point in this rambling thing that I was saying, but it got lost somewhere along the way. Hopefully I said some interesting stuff, though. I would also add another rambling point. You never actually got the whole... I mean, like, you were sort of feuding with these people at the time of COVID. And even though COVID just sort of petered out, you never really got your vindication, did you? I wonder why that is. I mean, will there ever be a time when we'll be able to examine the COVID thing that Russia did, just like everybody else? I mean, yeah, it
was total denial. I mean, it was either denial or I was attacked for, you know, besmirching the good name of Sputnik V, created by our friend Alexander Ginsberg, and, you know, basically all Hermann Graf, all of these hardcore Russia patriots who are deeply committed to public health in Russia. But you know, what can you say, Rollo? It's a thankless job. Like, just asking the uncomfortable questions or pointing out the uncomfortable information, it's always been thankless. You should know this, Rollo. You're a scholar. You should know. You just go look back at history and just look at all
same as you. Well, Marco didn't Mark, you people broke Marco. I hope you're happy. I mean, there was a guy who was way ahead of the curve on this one. Way ahead of the curve on this one. Like, ahead of me by 6 months. Easily, right? And, I mean, sure, we have different content. His was more, like, technical, talking about barrel lengths and stuff, and I'm not going to pretend to understand that. But, you know, he was basically the gist of what he was saying was 100% correct. And, you know, they basically destroyed him, you know, like the neglect that this man suffered. So, yeah, it's funny. And I hope he comes back. But, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of examples of this at play. Strelkov might end up getting arrested. I don't know. His court thing is still hanging over him. We haven't gotten any updates in a while on that. But I think another thing that people like that I've started talking about on the blog is Wagner and how that, you know, for one reason or the other, I'm sure Prigozhin's intentions are anything but pure and white as the driven snow. He is shining a light on all of this. And some people, you know, Strelkov's message got through to them because of his just something about him or his reputation. It resonated with people and they were able to listen to him. You know, with Prigozhin, it seems like he's bringing up a lot of people who were not convinced by Strelkov. And so maybe, you know, all we need is like another prominent guy that these people look up to. Maybe like Pepe Escobar, you know? Maybe just like a couple more like that, and there we go. And we'll have it. And we'll be able to break this thing. You know, there's also this like feedback loop, right? I'm not sure if I discussed it with you, but this idea that like you'd be surprised, but Russian media actually does reference what's his name, McGregor and Ritter and like American experts and stuff. And so if you can create this like loop, this self-containing cycle of disinformation where these people are disinformed by like the state or whatever, or they just lie on their own. And then they repeat it in English. And then the Russian media picks up on what they're saying. And so they kind of reinforce all this bullshit. And, you know, the weak-minded, feeble-minded peasant is not going to be able to like trace the train of logic. They're not going to back to, well, what was the origin of this claim? You know, they're going to be like, well, this guy says it and these guys say it, and these guys corroborate it. Yeah, but they're all just corroborating one another. You know, they've created this feedback loop, right? So you have this bizarre situation where the Russian state media is actually feeding us bullshit, but then eating its own bullshit. So, you know, we got to break through that. That's one of the things we could possibly do is sync these 5D people so that the Russian media can no longer use them to lie by saying, look, this American expert concurs with us. Yeah, he concurs with you because he read what you said. He's reading from the same notebook that you're reading from, right? Yeah, no way.
I would just add, look, I mean, I don't look, the reality of the situation is, whether people want to admit it or not, is that a lot of the so-called independent and alternative voices that are talking about this war are either directly or indirectly supported by the Russian government. This is just an objective reality. And whether they're, if they're not actually on the Kremlin's payroll, they are getting airtime on RT, or they magically have a Kontaktia account, which is Russian Facebook, maintained in Russian language by a team of Russians. Very interesting. How would one acquire such a devout following in Russia? I mean, it just, you could just go down. It's just, I'm sorry, but enough is enough. Like, we should just call it out and say that. And this is another reason why it's so difficult just to have an honest debate. And by the way, I'm not saying that if you get a paycheck from the Kremlin, or, you know, you write an article for Russian state media, that means that you're unable to discern, you know, reality from fiction. But at a certain point, there is clear that it will affect certain people, and that it there's a lot of, I would say there's obviously, I mean, I would hope there's obviously a lot of self-censorship going on here, right? I don't know, Rolo. It's just, It's a very strange. It's a very strange ecosystem.
Honestly, they're probably just being told by the FSB or somebody to like not say anything truthful, like not say anything bad about anything, right? But with what intention? That's what I don't understand. Like, I mean, these people could just be fulfilling some sort of, you know, create positive propaganda. Yes, sir. And then they just do it unthinkingly, uncritically, with mixed results. But it could be that. It could be, you know, lie so that people don't know the truth of what's going on. It could be like on that level of deception. I don't know. I think it's naive to think that these people are doing it, you know, like it's like, how can you be so critical when it comes to the West? Rightly so. If anything, they're not critical enough of the West. They won't go certain places. There's still a lot of topics they won't touch. They're actually quite tame. There are a lot more hardcore Western dissidents out there. So they don't really prove their like street cred to me with what they do critiquing the West, to be honest. But they don't even apply that same milk with toast. I've never actually used that word in speech. They don't apply their like same standard of criticism to Russia. And it's a shame that they don't, because when the liberals critique Russia, they're like, here's a problem that Russia has, and this is why Russia should be destroyed. You know, if you could use your brain power for good, you could be like, well, here's a guy who appears to be destroying Russia from within that the liberals will never tell you about because he's working with them or something like that. And, you know, here's some suggestions for how Russia should reform. Pride in who they are. They should understand that the West is not what it presents itself to be. You know, like there are positive ways that they could work to benefit Russia if they genuinely believed in that. And if they genuinely wanted Russia to be a contender, like to really stand up to the globalist world order or whatever. They don't do that. They take the easy way. And they're all allowed to live in the West, these fearless dissidents. You know, they're all allowed to, they all have property in the West. You know, they all live in the West. It's kind of weird, don't you think? I mean, they're right in the enemy's territory complaining about how bad, how tyrannical the Nazi West is. And yet they're allowed to do their thing. I'm not saying this is like a defense of the West. I'm saying maybe they're actually helping the West. You know, maybe there's something else going on here. I don't know. There's a lot of questions. This is a separate, and I don't, this is a separate topic. It's a separate podcast. I don't have any clear cut answers. We'll see. But you're right. It's been very encouraging to see Pepe sort of honestly ask questions now. Hopefully others do so as well. Do you want to say a couple final words?
No, not really.
Well, sooner or later. Another thing. Okay, that's the last thing I'll say. It's 30 seconds. Is that the elite know that the peasants, it takes them about 2 years to figure anything out. They've got like a good 2 years to basically do whatever they want before, you know, any significant numbers of people wake up to their machinations. So they can pull any scam. Like they can fight a fake war. They can start a fake pandemic. They can, you know, they can do an artificial economic recession. They can do anything. They've got like 2 years before people are willing to like calm down and evaluate the situation. At least, right? And so you've always got this lag, and the best that we can do is like train people to overcome this lag a little bit faster. You know, like, okay, it took you, you know, we clocked you in at 2.5 years last time. Let's see if we can get it down to 1.8. Can you do that? Can you do 1 year and 8 months to figure out the bullshit? Well done. That's your personal best. Now, if we could just get you down to about 9 months. 9 months to figure out that we shouldn't go into Iraq, you know, when it actually matters, when things are moving very quickly, right? You know, 9 months to figure out that WMD is a lie, right? You know, 9 months to figure out that COVID is a lie and we don't need these lockdown measures. You know, let's get you down to 3 months, and then once we can get the public down to like 3 months, 2 months, all of a sudden we can suddenly like actually have conversations in society that are meaningful. Because now, I mean, all we're doing is we're providing a record for the Chinese historians. It's going to take forever. It's going to take another year before these people wake up, most of them. I'm sure Russians, most of them are waking up way faster than Westerners. But it'll take a time. And then what will happen is if there's like a civil conflict or some sort of civil political struggle within Russia, these people will end up supporting the people like, you know, Kadyrov, who's a great Russian patriot, Shoigu, a great Russian patriot, You know, Lavrov, Peskov, just the whole the A team, you know, the Patriot team against people like, I don't know, like Strelkov or whoever, because they'll be like, oh, these are what Sacker calls the eighth column, you know, we got to get rid of them. So yeah, I mean, this lag is the problem. You know, I don't know how to defeat it. I guess you just have to, like, through repetition and examples, be like, hey, look, they tricked you last time. Here's what they told you, and you were pretty sure about that, weren't you? Well, this is kind of like that. Yeah, yeah. No, think about it. Yeah, so, but whatever. Do you have any of that last thing to add about that before I sign off, Riley?
Yeah. I think that the point you made about if we do see internal political strife, what are they going to say in the West? What are all of these 5D chess masters going to say, and who are they going to support? I think it's going to be very interesting to see who they go with, who they side with, who they cheer with. And I agree. I think they'll probably end up just taking the government line again, with disastrous results, misleading people, grifting, just terrible crimes against, I don't even know what to say. I also can't think anymore. It's what a time to be alive.
This guy wrote on my blog, he said, I always have a problem with paywall articles. I believe a really good-willed person or a true patriot who writes something in the hopes it contributes to the common good should want his message to reach as much people as possible and give up any earnings that might be made by a paywall. Why, what, is the fate of Russia not worth relinquishing a few bucks? So
How do we eat? What are we, how am I supposed to pay my rent, buddy?
He says the selfless approach should overweigh the selfish one. You see how morality is always weaponized against us? It's like, yeah, okay, these are great points. Why don't you go say those points on Martinov's blog, who gets $1,000 per post? Why don't you go say that to Lira? Well, I guess you can't. He's in prison. Why don't you go say that to literally any of the other people? Why don't you go to literally any of the other bloggers on Substack and tell them your thoughts on this? I agree with you 100%. I agree with you so much. I want you to spread your message far and wide. Go tell the other bloggers about this. You know? Thank you. I agree. You're super moral. Go be moral somewhere else. It's ridiculous. It's like, yeah, let's go to the guy who makes no money, pretty much. You know, what's his name? Fucking the Duran people. They make at least $600 per video at this point. I mean, if you look at the view count, they churn those puppies out, if not more. And it's like, why is it? It's always selectively used, right? Like against Strelkov too. Oh, why are you being like a traitor to your? Why aren't you being quiet for the greater good? Or why can't you pull together and, you know, just do what's best for the country? Why don't you take those questions and ask a Shoigu that? Why don't you ask him why his daughter can't pull together for the country? Why can't you ask that question to Peskov? Why can't you ask that question to the deputies who are with their whore wives in Europe? Why do they always come to us with these pretenses, you know? Like, is it because they think that it'll work on us? I don't know. I mean, I think maybe that's an unrelated point, but that's just another thing contributing to my complete disdain for the plebs. But okay, we can end it on that, Riley, unless you have something else to add. It was a good series. Thank you. We powered through it. We did good.
Yeah, well, we finished all 39 questions, and I think there were some good ones in there worth considering, and I'm sure that their significance are going to be coming up again and again in the coming days and weeks.
Yeah, you understand these questions. You understand everything that's going to happen next. All right, till next time. Bye-bye.